ladies and gentlemen, students, staff and visitors to the university, welcome to our second lecture from Dr. Don Brash. Dr. Brash is adjunct professor of banking in the business school. He'll be known to some of you as former Reserve Bank governor. He gained his PhD in economics from the Australian National University in 1965. He's particularly known for his 14-year tenure as governor of the Reserve Bank of New Zealand, where he gained a reputation for keeping tight control of inflation. In July 2002, Dr. Brash became a Member of Parliament for the National Party and leader of the National Party for 3 years, from October 2003. In an earlier career, he gave household economic advice to readers in the Women's Weekly as well, which I think is less well known. I confirmed that just before today. Today, he is chair of Huljich Wealth Management and holds directorships with Transpower, Ocean Partners and ANZ National Bank, where he is chair of the Risk Committee. In 2007, he was appointed adjunct professor at La Trobe University in Melbourne in the Faculty of Law and Management, and he's also been appointed adjunct professor of banking to the Business School here at AUT. So I think it's with great pleasure that I welcome Dr. Brash, who is going to speak on New Zealand's economic outlook. Can we ever catch Australia? Thank you.
Thank you very much for that introduction. I appreciate it very much. I've stood for election as a National Party candidate in 4 elections, in a by-election and 3 general elections, 1981, 2002 and 2005. So nobody would be unduly surprised when I say that I was pleased when the National Party won the largest share of party vote last year. And that's not just because I think that John Key will make a fine Prime Minister, or that I know most of the Cabinet pretty well, but rather because, speaking as objectively as I can, Helen Clark's Labour government was a profound disappointment to me and to many others who care about New Zealand's future. When Helen Clark was first elected Prime Minister in 1999, she said that her objective was to raise New Zealand's living standards to the top half of the OECD within a decade. What actually happened? Far from raising New Zealand's living standards to the top half of the OECD, we actually slipped back a rung or two during the 9 years in which Labour held office. This is extremely serious. If we continue to languish in the bottom third of the developed world, even worse if we continue to slide backwards, the things which have made New Zealand a pleasant place to live and work will gradually disappear. We won't be able to afford the health care which those in richer countries take for granted. We won't be able to afford the education which those in richer countries take for granted. Income distribution will become progressively less egalitarian, with all the social implications of that. Certainly, with the rest of the world in a severe recession at the moment, there are fewer New Zealanders heading abroad, and indeed many who left in the past are keen to come home. But within a few years, the world will recover, and with it, the temptation for New Zealanders to head overseas again. Of course, there are lots of reasons New Zealanders want to go overseas to live. Some go for warmer weather. Some go because they want to prove themselves on a larger stage. Some go because they're sick and tired of what they see as political correctness around race or gender in New Zealand. But almost certainly a key reason driving New Zealanders offshore over the last decade and more is that it's possible to make a markedly better standard of living for oneself and one's family in Australia or the UK or the US or in Singapore or in Hong Kong. And in this context, our standard of living compared with Australia is crucial. Australia is the easiest place for New Zealanders to move to. Australians speak almost the same language, play almost the same sports, look almost the same as most New Zealanders, and share a common heritage of British common law. There are already a large number of New Zealanders living in Australia, so that most people have family and friends already in Australia, making the move to Australia even easier. It's almost as quick and as cheap to fly to Dunedin from Sydney as it is from Auckland. And of course, Australians now have a markedly higher standard of living. Comparing living standards between countries is never straightforward, but it seems undeniable that Australians now are materially better off than we in New Zealand are. It was not always so. For more than a century prior to the 1970s, living standards in New Zealand were pretty much on a par with those in Australia, and sometimes they were better. Net migration between the two countries fluctuated around zero, with the annual movement of people depending very much on which country was enjoying a cyclical boom. But that all began to change in the 1970s. The precise number of people who head for Australia in any given year still depends on the state of the business cycle in each country. But the fluctuations are no longer around zero, but around a substantial net outflow. Official statistics for GDP per head suggest that Australians now enjoy incomes about one-third higher than we in New Zealand do, and the outflow of New Zealanders to Australia suggests that those statistics are broadly reflecting reality. Some observers believe that with Australia projected to come out of the current slowdown rather quickly, and rather more quickly than we in New Zealand are projected to do, the gap could well increase to 40% in the foreseeable future. I well recall Michael Cullen giving an answer to a question in the House about why it was that New Zealanders spend less than Australians do per capita on roading. I don't always agree with Michael Cullen, certainly didn't always agree with him when I was in Parliament, but I couldn't fault his answer. He said Australians spend more on roads than we do in New Zealand. Australians spend more on almost everything than we do in New Zealand. Australians are wealthier than we are. It may be that one of the consequences of the fact that our income levels went backwards relative to those in other developed countries between the mid-70s and the early 90s is that we got into the habit of spending far more than we earn. We want to maintain living standards on a par with those in richer countries, even though we haven't earned those higher living standards. So we overspend and sell assets to or borrow from foreigners to fund our overspending. It's a sobering fact that New Zealand's now more heavily indebted to foreigners than any but two other developed countries, and those two are Hungary and Iceland. Our net indebtedness to foreigners, the extent to which our gross foreign liabilities exceed our gross foreign assets, that net figure is estimated to be about 170 billion New Zealand dollars, or well over 90% of GDP, or about $40,000 for every man, woman, and child in the country. It's not the government which owes money to foreigners, the government no longer has any net foreign currency denominated debt owed abroad. It does have a small amount of New Zealand dollar debt owed abroad because foreigners are free to buy New Zealand dollar denominated bonds, and that figure will almost certainly grow as the government's borrowing program increases over the next few years. No, most of the foreign debt is owed by the private sector, with the largest single part of that debt being money owed by the banking system to fund an orgy of borrowing by the private sector, much of it to bid up the price of housing and enable dairy farmers to pay exorbitant prices for the farm next door. More worrying still, despite the very high prices we've enjoyed for export commodities until recently, we've been adding to that net foreign indebtedness at the rate of about $16 billion a year, roughly $44 million a day. I said I was pleased that John Key was able to form a government. I was ecstatic. One of the first things he did was negotiate a confidence and supply agreement with the ACT Party, under which the government is committed to lifting New Zealand's living standards to parity with those in Australia by 2025, and to setting up, and I quote, a high-quality advisory group to investigate the reasons for the recent decline in New Zealand's productivity performance, identify superior institutions and policies in Australia and other more successful countries, and make credible recommendations on the steps needed to fulfill Nationals' and ACT's aspirations, unquote. And as you may have seen, some days ago, it was announced that I would chair that advisory group. I very much hope that in that role, I'll be able to play a part in lifting living standards here to those in Australia, something which for me has been an almost lifelong ambition. Well, can we do it? Can we ever catch Australia? Well, one thing is certain. We will not catch Australia on our current track. All the signs are that if we simply continue, as we have done in recent years, the gap between living standards here and those in Australia will continue to get wider. If that happens, it's probably no exaggeration to say that Australia's attraction to more and more New Zealanders will rip us apart more comprehensively than Australian fast bowlers regularly rip apart the Black Caps, and as occasionally the Wallabies do to the All Blacks. Happily, there's every indication that the government knows this, and since last year's election, we've seen a useful start on the reform of the Resource Management Act, with the promise of more to come, a major increase in investment in the road network, the canning of some of the sillier parts of the previous government's investment program, and I think particularly of the Waterview Tunnel, and a commitment to look seriously at the obstacles created by the regulatory framework within which the business sector has to operate. Will it be enough? I don't believe anybody, whether in the government or in the wider community, thinks it will be yet. And I'm certainly not going to prejudge the conclusions of the advisory group which I've been asked to chair. But let me make a few preliminary comments. The first thing to say is that catching Australia is not about having New Zealand workers work harder or work longer. New Zealanders already work more hours per year than the workers in almost any other developed country. The popular wisdom, encouraged by some rather ill-informed remarks by Michael Cohen, is that New Zealand can't ever really catch Australia because of that country's enormous mineral wealth. And certainly Australia does have an abundance of mineral wealth. But New Zealand also has an abundance of natural resources. A report circulated by the World Bank just a few years ago ranked New Zealand second in the world, behind only Saudi Arabia, and well ahead of Australia in terms of natural wealth per capita, partly no doubt because of the quality of our farmland. We have more natural gas than we thought we had 3 or 4 years ago, and a very considerable geothermal resource. We know we have substantial quantities of coal and iron sands, even though a large part of the country has never been explored because it's locked up in the conservation estate. We have one of the largest saltwater fisheries in the world, and an abundance of fresh water, which almost certainly will be a very valuable resource in years to come. Moreover, the entire Australian mining industry contributes only about 5% of Australian GDP and employs only about 1% of the Australian workforce. It's only a few months ago that we were congratulating ourselves because we are an exporter of foodstuffs, not the exporter of minerals, because we thought that the things which Australian mineral resources were used to make, namely cars and flat-screen TVs, were things that many people could do without in a recession, whereas they would continue to eat. So we certainly can't complain that our natural resources somehow leave us at a disadvantage to Australia. Of course, even if we had virtually no natural resources, that would not condemn us to have low incomes, as Japan and Singapore have amply demonstrated in recent years. So that excuse for a gap in the gap in living standards simply won't wash. Perhaps the problem is that New Zealand is too far away from major world markets to enjoy the standard of living enjoyed by those in other developed countries. Some recent research by the OECD suggests that this factor will always mean that our standard of living will never quite equal that in the richest countries. But even if this were true, Australia suffers from an almost identical handicap. So while distance might mean that we can never quite overtake the US, there's no earthly reason why we can't overtake Australia. Moreover, to me, this distance argument is weak. After all, we had some of the highest living standards in the world until 30 or 40 years ago, even though at that time the average dollar value of a ton of our exports was almost certainly lower than it is now, and because transport and communication costs were vastly higher then than they are now, we were in economic terms even further from our major markets at that time. Maybe the problem is what Helen Clark called the failed policies of the past, but even Helen Clark couldn't really have believed that. The policies implemented by the Labor government of the 80s and the first Bolger government were mainstream by the standards of other high-income countries and were enormously beneficial to our growth potential. Between the two governments, Labor and National, subsidies to inefficient industries were largely removed. The tax system was made one of the most efficient in the developed world. Inflation was eliminated. Inefficient government trading operations were corporatized and in some cases privatized. Labor laws were substantially liberalized, and legislation was passed which led eventually to a very substantial reduction in the government's debt. After the initial trauma of those policy changes was passed, production per person in the so-called measured sector of the economy started to grow more strongly than for many previous years. Indeed, in the 8 years from 1992 to 2000, productivity growth in New Zealand was somewhat better on average than it was in Australia. Over the next 8 years, from 2000 to 2008, as the Labor government started reversing some of the previous policies, productivity growth in the measured sector of the economy slowed abruptly. So much for the failed policies of the past as a reclamation for our failure to close the gap with Australia. So why is there still a big gap between living standards here and those in Australia? Answering that question will clearly be the major focus of the group I'm about to chair, and again, as I've said previously, I don't propose to give any definitive conclusions on that at this point. It would preempt the work of the task force. But a number of explanations have been proposed in answer to the question. One is that Australian workers may have more capital, more plant and machinery, better infrastructure, to work with than New Zealand workers do. And that indeed seems to be the case. Although all estimates of this kind are fraught with imprecision, it seems clear that Australian workers have quite a lot more capital per person than we do in New Zealand. So the amount of output which each Australian can produce is also markedly higher than the amount of output which New Zealand workers can produce. Aha, you may be thinking, we must be investing too much of our savings in housing. And that's exactly what I assume. But OECD data covering the 16 years from 1990 to 2005 suggests that on average, over that 16-year period, we invested 5.4% of GDP in housing. 5.4. Lower than the OECD average and markedly lower than the 6.5% which Australia invested in housing. All right, so why do New Zealand workers have less capital per person to work with than their Australian counterparts? Part of the answer may lie in the fact that inflation-adjusted interest rates are higher in New Zealand than many other countries. But why is that the case? In a country where it's easy to borrow overseas, one would expect inflation-adjusted interest rates to be not too far away from inflation-adjusted interest rates overseas, adjusted for the risk of lending to a small and heavily indebted country. And perhaps high real interest rates here do only reflect the fact that we are small and highly indebted. But if real interest rates are relatively high in New Zealand, then why are we such enthusiastic borrowers and reluctant savers? I used to argue that we're reluctant savers because for decades the New Zealand government has told us you don't need to save because we'll provide for the education of your children, for your health care if you get sick, for the basic needs you have in retirement, and moreover, if you do save, if you're silly enough to save, we will steal your savings through high inflation. Well, I thought that was a plausible argument, but when I look around countries in Europe, their social safety nets are even more generous than ours. And while we had a high inflation period in the 70s and early 80s, it was not much worse than in Australia or the United States. Perhaps there's something about our culture. I will recall talking to the wife of a man called John Spencer. John Spencer, as some of you will know, used to own the ultimate monopoly. He owned the monopoly to produce toilet paper in New Zealand. And his wife came from Finland. Her name was Tuti. She's now died, unfortunately. She said to me, you know, in Europe, when people are thinking of getting wealthier, they're thinking of their grandchildren. She said, in New Zealand, if we can't get wealthy in 5 years, then to hell with it. And there's some truth in that. But I suspect the Australian culture is not, in fact, very different. And in any event, it doesn't explain why we were once among the most prosperous countries in the world and no longer are, unless policy changes have changed our culture in some kind of fundamental way. Still, another possibility is that our savings habits are not unlike those in other developed countries, or at least not unlike those in Australia and the US, when adjusted for the way we tax savings. In 2005, an OECD study suggested that as a share of GDP, New Zealand's tax on capital income, that's income arising out of profits and interest and dividends and so on, was the second highest in the OECD, second only to Norway. If this is correct, and given New Zealand has a relatively small stock of capital to work at, New Zealand's effective tax on capital may have been the highest in the OECD in that year. Of course, since 2005, we've seen the company tax rate reduce somewhat, and we've also had the introduction of the so-called PIE regime. But it's a sobering thought. And it may well be that this relatively heavy taxation on investment income is an important factor in the relatively small amount of capital which New Zealand workers have at their disposal, and as a consequence, a factor in our failure to close the gap with Australia. On the other hand, and as you know, all economists have at least two hands, some observers say that this explanation for our failure to close the gap with Australia was in fact nonsense. They point out that Japan has had some of the best savings rates in the world in the last two decades and has in fact scarcely grown at all. They argue that what distinguishes rich countries from poor countries is the quality of their institutions and the policies which go with those institutions. They argue that when New Zealand adopted the institutions and policies of successful countries in the late 80s and early 90s, we lifted our growth rate to that in successful countries, and when we started abandoning those policies gradually in the late 90s and more quickly after 2000, our productivity growth fell off quite sharply. Among other things, they point out first the rapid increase in government spending after the first MMP election in 1996, and especially after 2005, to the point where government spending as a share of GDP is markedly higher in New Zealand than in Australia. Secondly, they point to the increased complexity of the tax system as a consequence of the increase in the top personal tax rate in 2000, thus splitting the top personal rate from the company tax rate for the first time since 1988. Third, they point out the increased rigidities in the labour market as a consequence of the repeal of the Employment Contracts Act in 2000 and the refusal until this year to contemplate even a very short period during which an employer can dismiss an employee without the risk of costly personal grievance action. Fourth, they point out the extraordinary obstacles put in front of almost any new investment, be it in roads, electricity transmission, electricity generation, wood processing, or residential land subdivision by the Resource Management Act, and the way in which local and regional governments interpret that act to thwart investment and erode the property rights of owners. And they point to the capricious way in which the government overrode the rights of the shareholders in Auckland International Airport, and indeed the rights of two major international investors wanting to buy shares in that company, and the rights of telecom shareholders, when the government decided to unilaterally abrogate the agreement under which the company had been privatised. Is it any wonder these observers say that investors hesitate to invest in New Zealand? So there are lots of difficult questions to answer, and there will no doubt be a range of views within the advisory group. In broad outline, we know what it takes to achieve faster growth, and we have a pretty good idea of where New Zealand scores badly. But clearly there are differences of emphasis and interpretation, and the 2025 task force is going to need to identify the areas where the biggest sustainable payoffs can be achieved. So finally, we get back to the question, can we ever catch Australia? I've no doubt at all that we can, if there's a political will to do so. There is nothing inevitable about our relative decline. If it continues, it'll be because New Zealanders choose policies which give us that result. But note well, given the gap which has emerged between our living standards and those in countries like Australia, particularly over the mid-70s to the early 90s, would not be sufficient to lift our growth rate to the average of other developed countries or to Australia's growth rate. We have to grow consistently faster than Australia for many years, and that means we have to have better policies than Australia and better institutions across a range of policy areas. This is arguably the biggest challenge facing New Zealand since the Second World War. Small policy changes here and there won't cut the mustard. Substantial changes will be needed in government spending, in the regulatory framework, in investment, and in tax structures. And aside, I hope that the tax experts which Bill English has appointed to advise the government on the tax system will keep in mind the need to close the gap with Australia as they do their work. Some of the choices required to reach Australian living standards by 2025 will not be easy and will require political courage of a high order. But if we flunk those decisions, we have to accept the fact that our grandchildren will grow up cheering for the Wallabies. I'm greatly encouraged by the fact that the Prime Minister is personally committed to not let that happen. Thank you very much.
Now, Dr. Brash has kindly offered to answer a small number of questions. If you wish to ask a question, could you raise your hand and I'll give you the call, and would you identify yourself as a staff member or student or otherwise?
Hello, Vince. I'm hearing out from my earlock magazine. One of the anxieties that people must have about this group is that it may not be bipartisan, or at least multipartisan. Are you going to include people in your group from across the political spectrum and also from across representative of New Zealand?
Well, we only have five, myself and four others, so by definition almost it won't be fully representative of everybody. And finally, of course, the decision is not mine. I've expressed some views about the kind of people I like on the task force, but that will be a matter of negotiation between the government and the ACT Party, which of course was why the group was set up. I'm very much hoping that the group will have a broad range of views. And in fact, one of the names I've suggested to both Mr. Hyde and Mr. English is someone who is, in fact, from the Labour side of the political spectrum. We're not going to get every political party on that small five-person committee, and I don't think society will do that. And finally, politicians have to make the judgments about how far they're willing to make changes. That is a political judgment. We've been asked to make essentially a technical judgment. How do you do it? And politicians can then decide, well, it's all too hard, and not do it, or say, yep, we'll give it a go. But as I'm hoping we'll have a good spread of opinion on the group.
Hamish, and then the person after you. Hamish first.
You've used a number of statistics when you're talking about the difference between Australia and New Zealand. You talk about the fact that in the 9 years under the previous Social Democratic government, we flipped in terms of our rankings within the OECD. But when you go on to talk about the gap in the GDP per capita between Australia and New Zealand, you talk about the fact that Australia's GDP is about one-third higher than New Zealand. But what's of interest to me is it was around about 40% higher at the commencement of the previous government. So I'm interested in how that sits alongside your views that their policies actually hindered economic growth.
I've not seen that 40% figure, I must say, friend. The figures I used to quote in terms of after-tax average wages, and those are not, of course, GDP numbers, I admit, but the after-tax average wages had about the same in 1970 in two countries, a gap of about 20% by 1984, and Australian about 20% higher by 1984, much the same by 1999. They hadn't narrowed the gap over that 15-year period, but roughly the same. But between 1999 and 2008, my research people told me the gap had risen to about a third. So where the 40% figure comes from, I don't know.
Maybe it's GDP per capita.
As I say, I don't have those numbers, but the numbers surprised me, I must say. I'd be very surprised indeed if they'd come down in the last 8 years. Certainly productivity growth in New Zealand and Australia both fallen off quite a bit actually in the last decade, but we didn't narrow the gap in productivity growth over the last 8 or 9 years.
Would you be interested in seeing
I'm interested in seeing any numbers at all, absolutely. Yeah.
Adrian Schenker, back to New Zealand. In your speech you said that you hit up against New Zealand's habit of borrowing from foreigners and then selling assets to fund borrowing and overseas. I was wondering, does that mean that you are ruling out the idea of privatisation? Because that seems to mean selling assets to foreigners.
That last rough phrase was what?
Privatisation seems to mean selling our assets to foreigners.
I didn't mention the word privatisation in the speech at all. And I must say, if you look at my website, I gave a speech about a year ago when I had no thought at all that I might be involved in this role on the subject, Big Ideas to Supersize the New Zealand Economy. And certainly I don't recall ever using the word privatization in their speech either. So it's not one of my top priorities, even though people seem to assume that's my whole objective. It certainly isn't.
That should be the suggestion here, but you did say that New Zealanders had a bad habit of selling assets.
Oh, absolutely. No, I didn't say they had a bad habit of selling assets to foreigners. What I said was we're overspending. And to fund that overspending, we either borrow or we sell assets. Those are the only two options you've got. Same as, I mean, if you overspend, you've got no choice than to run down cash, borrow, or sell something you've got. Those are the options, in principle, you can use. And we've ran out of cash, so we borrow, or we sell assets. Now,
I think you've had a chance to make a point.
It's an important point. I don't want to run away from it. Privatization can sometimes mean selling assets to foreigners. It doesn't have to. I mean, Air New Zealand was sold, for example, was sold to Braemar, which at that point was predominantly a New Zealand company. I can't run through every example, but privatization doesn't necessarily require selling assets to foreigners. Indeed, in Eastern Europe, the method they privatized many things was by distributing shares to every citizen. What they did with it after that was up to them, but it doesn't. The privatization and selling assets to foreigners are not the same thing.
We do have another question over here and then there.
I was wondering if you can give your comment on redistribution of wealth within the country and how that funds up wealth rather than the single metric of the capitalistic growth that we are seeing now in the difficulties.
Give my view on it?
Yes.
I personally like a society where the income distribution is not too great. But one thing is absolutely certain. If we fall further down the income scale relative to other countries, that income distribution will get wider within New Zealand. Why? Because the people who are potentially most able to move to high-income jobs abroad are the most highly skilled. The surgeons, the doctors, the university lecturers, they can move to Australia or elsewhere very easily. So we have to provide for them, at least, some lifestyle-adjusted equivalents of what they could get in Sydney or Melbourne. Not exactly, but lifestyle-adjusted equivalents. Now, if the average is low relative to, say, Australia, and we have to give the skilled people some compensation to stay here because they're the ones who can most easily move, by definition it means the income distribution gets wider. So I don't see the two objectives as in any way in conflict. If you want a relatively egalitarian society, you dare not let your average income levels slip too far relative to the rest of the world.
I think the difference I'm getting at is the direction with the primary direction being growth in income rather than primary direction being distribution with growth sustaining it or supporting it. The primary direction is just growth per se. Redistribution takes a backseat and doesn't actually have income.
Well, let's put it this way. We've had quite a major emphasis on redistribution in recent years that may possibly have been at a cost in terms of growth. I mean, at the moment, I can't quote the exact numbers, but well over half the total income tax cake is paid by the top 10% of the population. So there's a lot of income redistribution going on now. And I'm not going to debate whether that's the right proportion or not, but what I am saying is that if you let your average drop too far below the rest of the world, income distribution within New Zealand will get wider.
Bernard Hickey from Interest.co.nz. Could you give us an idea of whether this process of improving our productivity can be done without making some people worse off to start?
I would hope not. But let's look back in history a bit. One of the things that happened in the 80s and early 90s, you recall, was that we removed very high protection for the manufacture of cars. or rather more accurately, the assembly of cars in New Zealand. Was that a good thing to do or not? Absolutely a good thing to do. A country of 4 million people could never sustain 10 motor vehicle assembly plants in any kind of efficient way. So removing that protection and subsidy for those things was the right thing to do. What is important if you do that is to provide the training and the assistance to help people out of what was a perfectly rational career choice until the government changed the policy into a different industry. That's what should happen, and to some extent it did happen, but you could argue it didn't happen enough. I'd be happy to agree that that might be true. But having them do things which make no sense at all in the long term doesn't make sense.
Hi there, I'm a student for the MBA in AUT. My question is there any particular sector in the industry, like New Zealand economy, that there will be placed extra focus on in terms of improving the efficiency?
I don't want to be too dogmatic on that. And the reason I say that is that in the 80s, the Labour government at the time described agriculture as a sunset industry. Productivity growth in agriculture has been higher in the last 25 years than any other major sector of the New Zealand economy. So if in fact the whole economy had been growing in terms of productivity as fast as agriculture had been, we'd be as rich as Australia. Much higher productivity growth in that sector than anywhere else. So I'm very acutely conscious of the risk for some economist or Wellington bureaucrat deciding that this sector is the winning sector and that sector is not. Just to quote an example to you, years and years ago in the 70s, I visited a company in Hamilton called A.M. Bisley. And A.M. Bisley used to manufacture, or engineer, grain storage and grain drying equipment and set it all over Southeast Asia, Indonesia, Malaysia, and so on. And I said, how on earth can you do that from Hamilton? Big, bulky, low value per ton equipment. How can you do that when you're so far even from a port? And they said, we can beat the Americans and the Canadians, the Japanese, we beat everyone doing that because every grain storage and grain drying equipment is different. Different grain, different humidity conditions, different shape of the ground. And they said, at that game, we can beat anybody. Well, lesson one. Sitting in Wellington, you wouldn't have thought of grain drying equipment as being something that New Zealand had any kind of comparative advantage of. Then I said, well, why aren't you exporting this stuff to India? Because at that time, India had a big grain surplus, had a good harvest, and as you probably know, when India has a good grain harvest, the rats eat some of the grain because they haven't got enough storage facilities, and India tends to have plenty of foreign exchange when the grain harvest has been good. I said, why aren't you exporting to India? They said, we cannot get enough metal workers. I said, why not? They said to me, because they're all assembling cars in South Auckland. Lesson number two. You don't see the industries which would grow up if you're protecting some industries which don't make sense at all. And we were assembling cars in a way which was nutty. By not assembling cars, we freed up metal workers in principle to make grain storage equipment which we could export to India. A much more effective way of generating income for those workers.
Thank you.
About a decade ago, I think there was a famous professor who came into New Zealand, Michael Porter, who came to advise New Zealand as to on the very same topic. Have you had a look at what he had said and why it has failed?
I did look at Michael Porter's work when it first came out. You say, 15 or more years ago now. I would have to dust it off and reread it, I think. I don't know why a number of the companies which identified as particularly likely winners didn't in fact do so well. But in a sense, it bears out my point earlier. No matter how clever you think you are, you don't always identify the growth opportunities which are out there. I spoke to a company this morning which is extremely successful internationally on a particular software project. But major customers all over the world, I'd never even heard of them. nobody has enough knowledge to be sure which companies or even industries will necessarily make a lot of progress. But let me just say, just in case anyone thinks that I'm against R&D or against science, whatever, I think we do have an opportunity of providing a lot more high growth companies in New Zealand based on New Zealand sourced scientific research. We're not making nearly enough advantage of that fact.
Dr. Burris, New Zealand Herald Online. talking about keeping our productive people in New Zealand, what are your thoughts on immigration of this production, of bringing people into the productivity into New Zealand in that respect?
Immigration?
Yes.
I'm in favour of it. that's a very simple way of answering the question. Mm. But I think New Zealand, well, New Zealand basically is an immigrant society. With a very few exceptions of fully, wholly Maori people, virtually everybody has at least one ancestor who's come here in the last 100 years. In most cases, most ancestors have come here in the last 100 years. So we're an immigrant society, and I think we've benefited enormously from that. Funny enough, my first wife was born in Kenya, my second wife was born in Singapore. So I'm in favour of immigrants.
I think we'll make this the last question, Roy. Oh, okay. So we'll have the last two. Roy first.
Dr. Bratt, in other countries, many governments the last couple of years have spent enormous amounts of money bailing out companies, putting money into infrastructure. Do you think the New Zealand government is doing about right? Too much? Too little?
Well, there are two different questions there in a sense. We haven't been bailing out companies in New Zealand, and I think, fortunately, we haven't. I think the government hasn't seen the need to bail out companies, as far as I know. The banks are in good shape, for which, thank heavens, because the countries which have got seriously damaged banks, like the United States and the UK and parts of Europe, are in very much worse shape than countries with the banking system in good shape. So that's one of the good things. People hate the Australian-owned banks. Funny enough, I think Australians hate the Australian-owned banks even more than we do. but I think we should be grateful that, in fact, they are among a very small number of AA or better rated banks in the world. So they've not had to bail out either banks or major corporates. Infrastructure, I think we have been under-investing in infrastructure for quite a long period of time. And I suspect that investing more in infrastructure is almost certainly the right thing to be doing.
And Dana. Just speak up.
You were talking about New Zealand's prospects in terms of catching up with wealthier nations such as you use the United States. Do you think, though, currently, given what's going on in Europe, economically and socially, it would be a model we'd want to emulate? It would be a model we would want to emulate, an American model, or would a Nordic model of high taxation, redistribution be a model we should be emulating?
I think it's a question of what New Zealanders themselves want. If we want to live in a relatively poorer society, then that's a choice we are absolutely entitled to make. But I was in politics when the big debate about Herceptin took place, which, as some of you will know, is a drug to cure some kinds of breast cancer. And if you look at a ranking of countries on the OECD per capita income level, virtually every country above us on that ladder provides a 12-month course of Herceptin. We and the rest of the world below us don't. It's a question of dollars. If you want the kinds of modern healthcare which people in rich countries want, we need to be richer. We can't opt to be poorer, but we have to accept that there'll be some things we will not be able to afford. Now, some of us may be happy to accept that and stay here. Won't affect me much. I don't expect to get breast cancer. that's a flippant remark. But I don't expect to need a lot of high-tech medicine. But plenty of people might. And if we want those people to have that kind of care, then the wealth of our society is crucially important. I suspect if you live in, I don't know, Zimbabwe, the idea of Herceptin is just absolutely out of any consideration at all. So it's really a question of what we want.
But with due respect, she wasn't comparing us with Zimbabwe. She was comparing us with Norway, Finland.
That's right.
Scandinavian countries where Herceptin would have been available.
Quite right. And they are richer countries than we are. That's my point. All the countries where Herceptin is available have higher per capita income than we do. And all I'm saying is, it's one particular example. But our medicine, as you all know, is getting more and more high-tech. And many of us in the room will want the best of modern medicine for the people we care about. If we want that, and want it free from the state, then our wealth as a country is crucially important, because it gives us choices.
Can I just, the part I asked at the beginning was about the United States. You know, you talked about catching up with America in terms of wealth. What I was saying, though, was a bit more asking you about, would we want to emulate an American model? Because as we know, in the States, the healthcare system is not what we see as ideal. In
I absolutely agree.
The social system, yep. All of those. So when we're taking a measurement of wealth as such, there's huge income disparity there, and probably as a country, we are still better off as a whole than the state.
Yep.
Can you comment on that?
Absolutely. I am not wanting us to emulate every aspect of the US society at all. In particular, I do not like their healthcare system. We're very clear on that point. So I'm not advocating holus bolus that we follow the United States or that we follow any particular aspect of the US policy. In some areas, I think they've done quite well. Other areas, they've done poorly, badly. So, you know, set that aside. I'm not after just emulating the US. But I do want New Zealanders to have the choice of having the very best medical care, the very best university quality that we can have, good quality housing. I want those things available for us if we choose to have them. And increasingly, we are being left behind. That's what I'm saying.
I think we can conclude the formal part of the afternoon there. You are all invited to the 9th floor for refreshments, however. Can I just thank Dr. Brash on your behalf? As an Australian, I find the way this dialogue is framed very interesting, actually, because I'm not sure Australia has solved many of the problems that we've been discussing at all. And if we were in Australia, I'm sure you could have a similar gathering where similar problems were discussed in terms of the Australian situation. Australia has also slipped over the last few decades in terms of wealth, in a comparative sense. Productivity is a major concern in Australia as well, even if it is a little better than here. So I think I was particularly encouraged to hear Dr. Brash talk in terms of not just catching up, but on a number of occasions overtaking Australia. I think that's a really worthwhile aim, because catching up may be easy if they continue coming down. So overtaking is the worthwhile aim, and I can only applaud it. And on behalf of all of you, I'd like to extend a very warm thanks to Dr. Brash.